Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to As It Is. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, with a program designed to help you learn and improve your American English. Today, we are going inside the human brain to see how and what people think. Some researchers say there is a connection between how you feel about yourself and how you do your job. Then, we will hear about children and music. Young people who study music and play instruments are smarter than those who do not, right? Some folks at Harvard University say, hold on. We are very happy to have your brains thinking about what we are sending your way today on As It Is. A new study says people who feel they lack social power find it harder to perform physical work. The researchers say their study is the first to show that people who believe they lack influence in society feel the weight of the world. Eun-Hee Lee is a candidate for a doctoral degree in the psychology department at Britain's University of Cambridge. She says the people in the study were not suffering from the continuing deep sadness known as clinical depression. Instead, Ms. Lee said the study was based on how the participants saw themselves. They rated themselves on what level they thought they held in the social order. They compared themselves to people they thought of as powerful and in control. She described what the study team meant by powerful.
We define being powerful as the one who has control over their own and others' resources, whereas being powerless as being the one who doesn't have their control over their own and others' resources and also have to depend on others to gain the resources that they need.
She said powerless people continually feel unsure. Researchers in the study examined participants to learn their feelings about their status or level in society. They presented them with a statement such as, I can get people to listen to what I say. The participants were asked to lift a number of boxes and guess their weight. The more powerless the people, the higher they estimated the weight of the containers. In a second test, the researchers asked participants to sit in ways that seemed powerful. In one example, they sat with one elbow on the arm of a chair. That position is domineering or commanding. Or they sat with their hands under their thighs, a restrictive position. People in the restrictive positions thought the boxes weighed more than they really did. Those who sat in the more powerful way made better estimates of the box's weight. Finally, a number of participants were asked to remember a time in which they felt powerful or powerless. Those who thought of a powerful time gave the best answers for the weight of several boxes. Those who remembered moments of powerlessness repeatedly said the boxes were heavier than they were. Ms. Lee believes feelings of lack of power in humans might have developed from prehistoric times. She says it might have been a way to keep early man from using up limited resources. But she says that today, these feelings might not be good for people at work.
It might mean that we are kind of preventing ourselves automatically putting 100% effort into the work without us realizing, which could be damaging.
The Journal of Experimental Biology published the study. Many people believe that teaching children music makes them smarter, better able to learn new things. But the organizers of a new study say there is no scientific evidence that early musical training affects the intelligence of young people. Jerry Watson joins us with details.
An estimated 80% of American adults think music classes improve children's ability to learn or their performance in school. They say that the satisfaction from learning to play a new song helps a child express creativity. Researchers at Harvard University, however, have found that there is one thing musical training does not do. They say it does not make children more intelligent. Samuel Mayer is a graduate student at Harvard School of Education. He said it is wrong to think that learning to play a musical instrument improves a child's intellectual development. He says the evidence comes from studies that measured the mental ability of two groups of four-year-olds and their parents. One group attended music class. The other went to a class that places importance on the visual arts, arts that can be seen.
The answer there is no. We found no evidence for any advantage on any of these tests for the kids who were participating in music classes.
Samuel Mayer says researchers have carried out many studies in an effort to learn whether musical training can make children smarter. He says the results have been mixed. He says only one study seems to show a small percentage increase in IQ, intelligence scores, among students after 1 year of music lessons. He does not believe that IQ is a good measure of a child's intelligence. He says researchers in his study compared how well children in the music training group did on mental processing tasks or projects. Then the results were compared to those of children who did not take lessons. There was no evidence that the musical training group did much better on the mental tasks than the other group. The researchers confirmed their results with a larger group of children and their parents. Mr. Mayer says music lessons may not offer children a fast, easy way to gain entry to the best schools later on in life. But he says the training is still important for cultural reasons. In his words, "We teach music because music is important for us." He notes that the works of writer William Shakespeare are not taught so that children will do better in physics. He says Shakespeare is taught because it is important.
And I don't think music needs to be any different than that.
A report on the benefits of music training in children was published in the journal PLOS ONE. I'm Jerry Watson.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Speaking of music, today is the birth date of a very famous American. 3 years before the turn of the century, in 1897, Marian Anderson was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She became one of America's greatest opera singers. Because she was an African American, she was not allowed to sing at Constitution Hall here in Washington. So, she performed before 75,000 people on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. She later became the first black woman to sing with the New York Metropolitan Opera. Marian Anderson died in 1993. And that is all for this edition of As It Is. But don't go away. There are more Learning English programs just seconds away. And world news follows at the beginning of the hour on VOA.
Learn when
Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. American Lamar Baylor spends most of his time in New York City. He works as a performer in the Broadway musical The Lion King. But since 2011, he has also spent weeks in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. There, he teaches dance to boys who live on the street. His teaching is part of an effort by the Rebecca Davis Dance Company. The project helps young people learn more about dance and learn how to behave in a classroom environment. Lamar Baylor describes his students as genocide survivors. They have lost all of their families. Some have been in jail. Others have sold their bodies for sex.
They have been through things that no one should ever have to go through.
He says dance classes provide the children with structured learning and self-expression that they have never had before. Rebecca Davis is the founder and director of the dance company. She says she got the idea for the project after she visited Rwanda in 2008. She remembers meeting a large number of street children who were dancing. And she thought that dance could be used to get them off the street and into a safer place. Rebecca Davis believes that learning to dance is a step toward education.
When you start to play music in Rwanda, these kids come out of nowhere and they enter this center. And it's because of dance that they have a way of exchanging their physicality, their survival skills that they learn on the street and their strength into something that's actually artistic and aesthetic.
She says children can take classes in information and technology after they have learned to attend classes and follow directions. Boys who have done best in the classes win scholarships and are sent to the Sunrise Boarding School. About 30 boys have won this kind of financial aid. She says all the students are male because few girls in Rwanda live freely on the street. The Rwanda program is the largest one set up by the Rebecca Davis Dance Company. But Ms. Davis has also set up dance programs in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Guinea. About 2,000 children in the three countries have taken part in the project since it was launched in 2010. As for Lamar Baylor, he knows from his own experience how dance can lead to a better life. He is from Camden, New Jersey. Camden has sometimes been called America's poorest and most dangerous city. Mr. Baylor says that growing up in Camden, it took a long time for him to find out what he wanted to do. He now thinks dancing saved his life. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Bob Doty.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week in our series, we talked about the election of 1828. General Andrew Jackson defeated President John Quincy Adams
after a campaign in which both sides made strong and bitter accusations. On March 4, 1829, Andrew Jackson was sworn in as president. The sky over Washington was cloudy that day, but the clouds parted and the sun shone through as Jackson began the ride to the Capitol building. Thousands of cheering supporters saw this change in weather as a good sign. So many people crowded around the Capitol that Jackson had to climb a wall and enter from the back. He walked through the building and onto the open area at the front where the ceremony would be held. The ceremony itself was simple. Jackson made a speech that few in the crowd were able to hear. Then Chief Justice John Marshall swore in the new president. In the crowd was a newspaper man from Kentucky, Amos Kendall. "It is a proud day for the people," Kendall wrote. "General Jackson is their own president." From the Capitol, Jackson rode down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Behind him followed all those who had watched him become the nation's seventh president. The crowds followed him all the way into the White House, where food and drink had been put out for a party. Everyone tried to get in at once. Clothing was torn. Glasses and dishes were broken. Chairs and tables were damaged. Never had there been a party like this at the president's mansion. Jackson stayed for a while, but the crush of people tired him, and he was able to leave. He spent the rest of the day at his hotel room in Virginia. The guests at the White House finally left after drinks were put on the table outside the building. Many of the people left through windows because the doorways were so crowded. Jackson was popular with many voters who saw him as representing the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his own vice president, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. Calhoun wanted to become the next president, but Jackson preferred his Secretary of State, Martin Van Buren. The split between Jackson and Calhoun deepened over another issue. Jackson learned that Calhoun had once called for Jackson's arrest. Calhoun wanted to punish Jackson for his unauthorized military campaign into Spanish Florida in 1818. The most important division between the two men was Calhoun's belief about who had more power, the states or the federal government. Calhoun came to believe the rights of the states were stronger than the rights of the federal government. His feelings became well known during a debate on a congressional bill. The year before Jackson took office, Congress passed a bill to require taxes on imports. The purpose of the taxes was to protect American industries. The state of South Carolina, Calhoun's state, opposed the measure. South Carolina, like other southern states, had almost no industry. It was an agricultural area. Import taxes would only raise the price of products the South imported. South Carolina refused to pay the tax. Calhoun wrote a long statement defending South Carolina's action. In the statement, he developed what was called the Doctrine of Nullification. The doctrine declared that the power of the federal government was not supreme. Calhoun argued that, instead, supreme power belonged to the states. He said states did not surrender this power when they approved the Constitution. In any dispute between the states and the federal government, he said, the states should decide what is right. Calhoun argued that if the federal government passed a law that any state thought was not constitutional or against its interests, that state could temporarily suspend the law. The other states of the Union, Calhoun said, would then be asked to decide the question of the law's constitutionality. If two-thirds of the states approved the law, the complaining state would have to accept it or leave the Union. If less than two-thirds of the states approved it, then the law would be rejected. None of the states would have to obey it. It would be nullified, canceled. Senators Robert Hayne of South Carolina and Daniel Webster of Massachusetts debated the question of nullification in Congress. Senator Hayne spoke first. He said that there was no greater evil than giving more power to the federal government. The major point of his speech could be put into a few words: liberty first, union afterwards. Senator Webster said Hayne had spoken foolishly. Liberty and union could not be separated, Webster said. It was liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable. No one really knew how President Andrew Jackson felt about nullification. He made no public statement during the debate. Leaders in South Carolina developed a plan to get the president's support. They decided to hold a big dinner honoring the memory of Thomas Jefferson. Jackson agreed to attend the dinner. The speeches were carefully planned. They began by praising the democratic ideas of Jefferson. Next, they discussed South Carolina's opposition to the import tax. Finally, the speeches were finished. It was time for toasts. President Jackson made the first one. He stood up, raised his glass, and looked straight at Vice President John C. Calhoun. He waited for the cheering to stop. "Our union," he said, "it must be preserved." Calhoun rose with the others to drink the toast. He had not expected Jackson's opposition to nullification. His hand shook, and he spilled some of the wine from his glass. Calhoun was called on to make the next toast. "The Union," he said, "next to our liberty, most dear." He waited a moment, then continued. "May we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states and by giving equally the benefits and burdens of the Union." President Jackson left a few minutes later. Most of those at the dinner left with him. The nation now knew how the president felt, and the people were with him, opposed to nullification. But the idea was not dead among some people in South Carolina. The nullifiers held a majority of seats in the state's legislature at that time. They called a special convention. Within 5 days, convention delegates approved a declaration of nullification. They said citizens of South Carolina need not pay the federal import taxes. The nullifiers also declared that if the federal government tried to use force against South Carolina, then the state would withdraw from the Union and form its own independent government.
This cut very deeply with Jackson. Jackson was a nationalist. He was a great believer in the federal union. He was a flag-waving patriot. And as Jackson saw it, nullification was the beginning of the end of the United States as a nation.
That was historian Daniel Feller. He says Jackson believed in a limited federal government. But that did not mean the people of every state should decide what the Constitution means.
That way lies chaos. As Jackson said, either we have a national government or we don't. And if Congress does pass laws which might prove to be unconstitutional, we have a procedure for dealing with that. We have the Supreme Court. We have the ability of the people and their elected representatives to appeal to Congress to repeal those laws, to take them back. But you can't have every state going off on its own and deciding what the Constitution says.
Jackson wrote a proclamation answering the nullifiers. In it, he said, America's Constitution formed a government, not just an association or group of sovereign states. South Carolina had no right to cancel a federal law or to withdraw from the Union. Jackson explained that it was his duty as president to enforce the laws of the land. Even as Daniel Feller says, if he had to use force.
It's going to come to a test of arms, and then, and this I can quote, and it was in italics, underlined, emphasized in the printed version of the proclamation. Disunion by armed force is treason. Are you really ready to incur its guilt?
Jackson sent 8 warships to the port of Charleston, South Carolina, and soldiers to federal military bases in the state. While preparing to use force, Jackson offered hope for a peaceful settlement. In a message to Congress, he spoke of reducing the federal import tax that hurt the sale of Southern cotton overseas. He said the tax could be reduced because the national debt would soon be paid. Congress passed a compromise bill to end the import tax by 1842. South Carolina's congressman accepted the compromise, and the state's legislature called another convention. This time, the delegates voted to end the Nullification Act they had approved earlier. They did not, however, give up their belief in the idea of nullification. Daniel Feller says one reason is because Southern politicians thought they might need to use nullification later. An anti-slavery movement was beginning to grow in the country. Some Southerners worried that Congress would one day make laws they did not like against slavery. The issues of slavery and states' rights would continue to be areas of conflict. Eventually, they would help start the Civil War in 1861. But well before that, President Andrew Jackson would fight a different battle. The struggle over the Bank of the United States will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.